More from U.S. Naval Academy history professor Wayne Shaw as he examines the generalship of Ulysses S. Grant. This class is part of a course called The American Way of War. It's 50 minutes.
All right. So today we will do Grant. With Lee, obviously, one of the ways that class was structured was you had, obviously, one historian who thought Lee was an excellent battlefield general and a terrible strategist, and then you had another historian, my former teacher, Gary Gallagher, who made the argument that, no, Lee's strategy was plausible. It didn't work out, but it wasn't because his strategy was implausible or not well executed. Today is what you might have noticed is I didn't really give you an anti-Grant reading, meaning Grant is terrible. And the reason for that is the consensus view amongst most modern historians is that Grant was a great general. I mean, that really is the debate. I mean, not everyone's going to agree with that. There's always issues for debate. But the current scholarship is extraordinarily positive. I more or less subscribe to that view. And it's hard to get a really good Grant the Butcher reading that some of you have heard this term, give you a current reading like that that's actually plausible. All right, so I don't. But I should mention that. I mean, historiography, meaning the changing interpretations about the past, Grant's example is very interesting about that, because Grant, during the war, right after the war, what happens to Grant, you know, after the war, that shows how Americans like him. He becomes president. He's incredibly important. He writes his memoirs are. How many of you actually read pieces of Grant's memoirs? Okay, a few of you, right? Maybe even in an English class. I mean, Grant is, and even in the history of American prose style, Grant is important because we call it the plain style, the type of writing we teach, the very kind of unvarnished, clear, taking out a lot of the rhetorical flourishes we associate with Victorianism, with romanticism. Grant actually has something to do with that. So Grant's reputation is very high. And then you have this turn where people become sort of indifferent to him, and you even get a very powerful, driven in large part by the writings of former Confederates, where Grant is portrayed as Grant the Butcher. So for those of you who've heard that, I think a few of you have, and what's the criticism of Grant? And you can also draw that out of Weigley, although he clearly sees Grant as still a great general. I mean, what's the complaint about Grant, you think?
Kind of throws his men away?
Yes. Okay. That Grant is extraordinarily bloodthirsty. You know, you get all sorts of stories, things like supposedly Grant liked his meat very well cooked, partly because he had worked in a tannery at one point. And, you know, the criticism, well, you know, there's this bloodthirsty general who can't stand the sight of blood, but who wastes his men and things like that. So you get all this very, very negative, very hostile interpretation. And then really around the time of the interwar period, a few important British military writers really start to rehabilitate Grant and who see him as a much more important general and give the interpretation that Weigley more or less repeats here. And what you got in Weigley's reading is kind of the consensus view, although there'll be people will dispute pieces, including myself, and adjust things here or there. But that's more or less the general view. All right. So, but you should realize that Grant's reputation has ebbed and flowed. And I still want you, though, you to sort of make an evaluative judgment. But it does tend to inspire less debate than Lee. All right. And I wouldn't be surprised if this class is affected to some degree about that, or maybe it isn't. All right. So, why don't we step back after giving you that little bit of context? Why don't some of you start fleshing out why is Grant, at least in the reading you got, why is Grant a great general? What makes him special?
He wins.
Okay. All right. That is a great opening line. You've kind of advanced the class in a way. I wanted to get to that issue. Right. I mean, this sounds preposterous, right? But there's a reason why Grant's reputation is always going to be easier to defend than Lee's. Because he wins the war, right? And Lee doesn't.
Sir, Wyman also argues that he's like this long-term, like he sees the bigger picture of things. It's not this like instantaneous battle where he has to like his ultimate goal is to crush Lee's army, but He sees like the bigger picture of the war.
Okay.
He's if at that level of three. What are those three levels of war again?
Right. Strategy. Operations. Tactics. Right.
And all right, Grant is the master strategist. Does Grant always get his way at the operational and tactical level?
No.
All right. Does anyone remember an example? It's one of them are you reading. What happens at Shiloh? Is that Grant's greatest battle, really?
No.
No. Because what? Well, what happens? Yes, okay, the federal army is, and Sherman has some doing with this. The Union Army is basically caught napping to some degree. All right. But how does Grant retrieve the situation? Weigley sort of refers to it as a certain character trait.
He just kind of holds in there.
Yeah, Grant doesn't panic. All right. So he recovers, all right, but it doesn't mean that he's flawless operationally. It doesn't mean that he's flawless tactically. All right. Mr. Connors, did you?
I think his thing is that he's got the nerve. McClellan breaks and Burnside breaks. All these other generals break, but Shiloh, he doesn't break. The Wilderness, when he actually gets his flanks, he gets outflanked, he doesn't break, he just withdraws and stabs again.
Yeah. And how does that relate to having the big picture? How do those two connect?
Well, if he loses his battle, it doesn't necessarily mean he's done with it.
Yes.
So he's able to get over the fact and move on to the next one.
Okay, so there you have here, and this is a traditional military historian's argument about why you focus on generals, right? Weigley uses it. Who's the contrasting figure to Grant on this question of character? Who's the guy who gets the strategy right, but due to a moral failing, I mean, that's basically the way 19th century Americans would have seen it, doesn't succeed?
McClellan.
It's McClellan, right? If you notice, what's Weigley's evaluation of the strategic concept of McClellan's peninsula campaign?
It's pretty positive.
Yes.
It's just he didn't have the guts to follow.
Yeah,
up.
Exactly. All right, that is what. And not only that, what does Weigley talk about? How does he characterize McClellan's political ideas?
He was a lot less revolutionary than, well, it seemed the Civil War seemed to turn out like he would have rather had the Civil War carried out so that there weren't any changes, slavery wasn't touched, and the Union was restored how it was.
Yeah. And whether or not that was really a good or bad thing, is it plausible in Weigley's view? Mr. Roth, did you say something?
I said it wouldn't be plausible to bring the Union back together, in that opinion, because the South was in their own mindset, like, you know, they wanted the war to end, and they wanted to stay the same way they were.
Okay, Weigley is kind of on the fence. I think if you read his other work, there's a sense in Weigley that battle and wars are, there's a lot of downsides to them. So he clearly has a fondness for McClellan's desire to have a military strategy that leaves civilians alone and things like that. And Weigley doesn't seem to care a huge amount about slavery, arguably. So that's one of the reasons why he can take that position. But I think you're right, Mr. Roth, to also say that other points, Weigley seems to indicate that's politically that strategy probably wouldn't have worked also. I mean, that there was something deeply implausible about it. But that it becomes completely implausible because McClellan fails on the battlefield, right? His only chance to make his political strategy work requires him to achieve a military victory, which he does not, right? And then you're replaced with the Grant strategy, which is much more, So Grant has the better strategic conception, but let's flesh out then. Let's step back again. He's got the good strategic view, but what's his strategy in Weigley's view? And it's the title of the chapter, right?
Annihilation.
The strategy of annihilation. What does that mean?
Destroy the army.
Okay. So how are the different ways of doing that, Mr. Roth?
He's gonna follow. The big thing is he had people follow Lee's army. And they just keep picking off people at a time and follow him and just make Lee, like, make the mistake.
Okay, so, or Mr. Goodman,
I would say, as well as, it's not just following Lee's army as well as Johnson. He divided his forces to engage the Southern armies at the same time on multiple fronts.
Okay, so you have various examples, right? You have attrition. What's that a fancy term for? It's what Mr. Roth just said to someone.
Just keep
killing out.
In this case, you can associate it with guerrilla warfare, that's true. But in this case, it's wearing down wearing down your opponent. And that's the Overland campaign, with a lot of fighting, a very high casualty count. All right. As Mr. Goodman, you're probably thinking of a different... Did you mention the Vicksburg campaign, I think?
No, not this time, sir.
All right. But, I mean, that's an example where Grant doesn't wear down his opponent through a heavy casualty sort of grinding away. What does he do instead there?
Well, he carried out a siege, but originally when he first started at Vicksburg, then he launched two or three assaults and failed at that. So, I mean, one could argue that he tried to annihilate Southerners or the Confederate Army at Vicksburg, too.
He does, but in the end, he does win, though, right? The assaults don't work, but the siege, how does the siege conclude? Yeah. Okay, where else does Grant achieve maneuver that leads to siege, to decisions by siege?
Petersburg.
That's actually another one, that's true, although it's not really maneuver that gets him there, arguably, right? Although he tries to get there. Yes, Forts Henry and Donelson. Right. Also, what makes Grant innovative about some of those? This is the inner service thing. What's Grant? Yes.
He forced an unconditional surrender from a lot of the.
But what service helped him out? You're right.
The Navy.
Right. Okay. So and what other campaign is the Navy very useful for him?
The West.
In the West. So Henry, not Vicksburg. Okay, it's Vicksburg who runs him Bass. You guys probably hopefully remember that from HH-104. Right. So you have here, the goal is to annihilate, at least in Weigland's interpretation, Confederate military power by destroying armies. But you notice the way to destroy armies, there are multiple versions of it. Right? What does Grant not always seek for? And this is why Weigley sees him as so praiseworthy.
He doesn't always look for a battle.
Yes.
He actually criticizes Scott for going through unnecessary battles and losing men when he could have gone around objectives and still abstained.
In what earlier war?
The Mexican
yes,
War.
Exactly. Right. Who is the exponent of a Napoleonic strategy in Weigley's view? It's the chapter you read before that in the book.
Lee.
Okay. So Grant wants to destroy, I mean, and I want you to understand this, because when Weigley says a strategy of annihilation, he's not meaning necessarily a battle, right? Because battles are at the operational and tactical level, right? He's meaning, in this case, he's basically saying there are other ways of achieving that objective which are more effective, and generally, especially the option of maneuver leading to siege, are far less costly, right? What's the other thing that we've put up, that hasn't been put up here, and it involves this issue of non-combatants? Mr. Rock?
Take away all the supplies.
Yes. Okay. All right. Attacks on, and how do you do that? Let's not sugarcoat it.
You attack fields, you attack villages.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that is, it is you move through the countryside, you take what you can consume, but you also, why do you also need to do that? You have to feed your army. And, well, what's the alternative, though? What's McClellan's alternative to feeding your army? You don't have to take stuff from civilians to feed your army. The American military doesn't do that nowadays. Yeah, you have to live off extended lines of supply. Or you can do things like you can actually pay people. Right? I mean, the Confederates do this in Gettysburg. They give people vouchers, and you can get paid in Confederate money. Right. I mean, the Federals could have done this. And don't take that to, in the 18th century, European armies sometimes do this seriously, by the way. People actually get compensated for the stuff. Right. But by Grant's, late in the war, the Federals are not doing that anymore.
Okay. However much those Confederate dollars are worth.
Well, I mean, U.S. dollars probably would have been worth more, right? But it's asking a lot for, you know, you're not being terribly respective to Southern white civilians if you're paying them in currency that they don't see as legitimate, right? So, but they're not even bothering with that fig leaf. They're just taking the stuff, and what they can't consume, what happens to it? It's deliberately destroyed, right? By the way, Weigley, I want to give you a sense here. Weigley is the consensus view in the historiography around nowadays is that, yes, there's a lot of deliberate destruction of civilian property. Yes, this is by no means a sugar-coated thing. But generally, civilians are not killed. The incidence of things like rape and sexual assault is very low, especially when you compare it to other conflicts, at least with white civilians. African-Americans, unfortunately, becomes a different issue. But even then, relatively low. And measures are made. We don't really also have a lot of evidence of mass starvation. during the Civil War. I mean, there just isn't much evidence of that. So people have to flee for their lives, and their livelihoods are destroyed, but they eventually find a place where they can get food. And we even have evidence that the federal army will, for example, leave enough that people won't starve, but they'll destroy everything else and be really rude and obnoxious about it. All right. But that's, you know, this is this issue of, you know, attacking the Confederate economy. And Grant is the overall, part of the overall mastermind of this, but in Weigel's view, who is the person who really executes this to the farthest degree? Sherman. Right. But obviously, Grant is a part of this set of schemes. Right. So here you have some of the different methods of annihilating Confederate military power, okay, that Grant embarks on, and which Weigel sees as, if nothing else, successful. Right. And that's the argument. All right, that at the strategic level, that is where Grant's exodus comes in. And not only that, he has the personality traits. Now, this is why in military historians' views, generals still do matter. Right? You can be like McClellan and have a plausible strategy at least. But if you can't execute it, because in McClellan's case, at least you sort of he loses his nerve, then the game is up for that strategy. It's not going to be operationally effective. All right. Let me step back. This is Mr. Schmelich's point. Grant is on the winning side of the war. Right? But someone give me an argument as to, okay, so what? I mean, why is that not necessarily mean that he's a good general?
We are probably in the South.
Yes, right? If you know, you've got to, this is, all right, Mr. Roth, why don't you elaborate on that more?
I think there was like a line in the book that said that we had more people at the peak of the Union military than the Confederates had in general.
All right. Okay, some other.
I mean, the North is a lot more industrialized than the South was.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and so how much credit do we give generals for having bigger resources, right? Here's another issue, we haven't really talked about this even with Lee. Who does Grant fight in the West where he makes his career? I mean, is this the best Confederates have to offer? No, right? None of you can probably remember these folks. Guys like, well, Weigley likes Joe Johnston a lot, right? But, you know, but Grant's, I mean, people like Braxton Bragg, Pemberton. You know, this is sort of this rogues gallery of ineptitude and auto honesty in the Confederacy, right? How can one use the same argument that great generals require sort of inept opponents in Lee's case? This is the same issue in evaluating Lee. Who does Lee fight?
Allen, Burnside. Yeah.
You know, Joe Hooker, right? Okay. Right, the Army of the Potomac in general, right? But arguably, the Army of Tennessee is perhaps an even worse army than the. I mean, the Confederate Army of the Tennessee is an even worse army than the Union Army of the Potomac, right? So, and when I say that, I mean things in terms of. I mean, you can actually make that argument. The Confederate Army of the Tennessee is plagued, and we don't have time to cover that in this class. Well, maybe some of you did in Professor DeCretico's. Is it a happy relationship within the army, the Confederate Army of Tennessee's high command?
No, it's a mess.
Right. Well, because what's going on?
The generals like each other.
Yes.
They're all at each other's throats.
Yeah. And Davis never adjudicates the issue, right? Davis probably should have picked one side and fired everyone else, right? Because you have essentially a corrupted command climate. Instead, he stays with Bragg for too long, but he doesn't fire Polk, who's the leader of the anti-Bragg faction. So they're all attempting to undermine Bragg, and it's just sort of this, and Bragg's sort of this difficult human being. You know, we think he might have had stomach problems, maybe he'd been really cranky and things like that. So you've got great stories. There's a great story, for example, of Braxton Bragg in the old army, the antebellum army, of how he had to be dual-hatted. He was, I think, a line officer, and he was, I think, the quartermaster of his company. That happened a lot. You had to do double duty. The army was very small. And he actually sent a requisition to himself as a line officer that he then rejected as a staff officer. I mean, this story is probably apocryphal. It's probably fake, but it says something about, I mean, Grant relates the story. It says something about what everyone knew about Braxton Bragg. And supposedly his superior said, you know, sir, you have quarreled with everyone else in the army, and now you have quarreled with yourself. right? I mean, it's sort of this, I mean, that's who you have as the primary Confederate field commander for a long time. And then, as you know, in the case of Lee, as you probably know more, you have folks like McClellan. And McClellan, actually, in all honesty, looks pretty good compared to Burnside. Right. So, well, he doesn't do very well, though, right? So, all right. So you have here a success of numbers. And it comes back to this issue is how much can we really put, how much credit can you really give to an individual general for their success or failure? And how much of it is due to circumstances beyond their control, whether it be who happens to be their opponent, whether it is what happens, what's the material resources they can call upon, what's the political restrictions they're operating under, right? What's the institutional structures? Ms. Denard.
During the time period, like what time of the war were they in? Because certain years of the war, there was less likely for their troops to run away and flee. And then other times, they just weren't feeling it. They weren't as dedicated to the cause or the cause that they didn't see for that.
And these are things that no individual can control. I mean, some people have, even those who are very pro-Grant have acknowledged, what's good about him being sort of the obscure Western theater early in his career? But he gets less political interference. He gets less exposure. So he can make mistakes. If Grant had done Shiloh in the East very early on, what probably would have happened to him? Erwin McDowell, by the way, at Bull Run, does okay, arguably. Erwin McDowell's army is very motivated, but terribly inept. And that's actually not McDowell's fault. And it's a close call. But what happens by necessity to McDowell after losing the first battle when everyone expects to win it? He gets fired. And McDowell's career never quite recovers. It's not as if, I'm not saying that McDowell was some great general, but McDowell, even as a corps commander, is always going to be plagued by this sense of you're the guy who lost the first battle, even though really rationally, it wasn't really just his fault. I mean, a lot of things went wrong, and he for someone with his level of inexperience, which is true of everyone else, he did okay, right? Lee is like this, too. Does Lee do so great in Western Virginia? He does terrible, right? Why is Lee even put in command of the army, what later becomes the Army of Northern Virginia?
Johnson gets injured.
Johnson takes a bullet and is literally incapacitated, right? Where's the other four-star, right? He happens to be in Richmond. Put him in command. The rest is history, right? Lee has nothing to do with that. And you can make the same argument about various episodes in Grant's career. Right? So most of you know a little bit, you know, what's Grant's antebellum career like?
It wasn't great.
He does pretty good in Mexico. He has an excellent combat record in Mexico. But then the very boring world of a regular army garrison life becomes problematic, and some of you probably heard of Grant's. What did Grant like to imbibe? Right? I mean, that's sort of some issues with alcohol, and it's still controversial if that ever comes up during the war. Some people say there are a few episodes of it. Some people say none at all. Although the consensus is he obviously does fine, so mischaracterizing him as a drunk would be pretty foolish. But he gets out of the army, and he's sort of pulled back into the service because he happens to be a person who knows how to be a mustering officer. And then he gets a regiment, and then he gets various opportunities. He makes the most of them, but all of these things are kind of happenstance and strangely random. Unlike Lee, who's second in his class. Scott wants him to take command of the army very early in the war. He has this tremendously distinguished career, not just in Mexico, but throughout the rest of it. But Grant, obviously, there's a lot of randomness involved in this. Right? So that's something to consider about when you evaluate the question of are there good generals or not. Now, why would an institution like the Naval Academy tend to want to focus, though, on generalship? What is it about our mission here?
Officership?
Yes. Right. I mean, what would it do to the Naval Academy's own self-conception if all of our classes talked about, well, you know, there are all these institutional and contextual and bureaucratic factors, and a lot of it's just blind luck. Right. So why might especially the folks at Bancroft Hall be just a little concerned if that's what I was telling you all the time?
Didn't want to choose this institution.
Yeah. All right.
Also, how might it be how might it hurt, even if all those statements are true, how might it hurt the organization if everyone just thinks of, you know, it's really context that matters, it's really...
You develop people who are passive and become victims of their environment.
Yeah, exactly. Have any of you heard of Clausewitz's concept of friction? Maybe. Okay, Mr. Goodman.
It's the fog of war.
Yes. Right. That in wars, even simplest things become difficult because wars are so plagued by uncertainty, by chance, and also fear, right? And people are getting killed, and things just don't quite seem to work right a lot of times. And also, there are very human things. We'll have a staff ride, an optional staff ride in this class, but when we go to Spotsylvania, I'll point out things like, and you get this more when you study individual battles, people get tired. They run on too little sleep. They're asked to make decisions of incredible importance, and that's why mistakes are made. Stonewall Jackson's a great example of this. What happens to him? He's shot by his own men, right? We'll talk a little bit about this when I do Spotsylvania, but Longstreet, if you know, is shot near where Jackson is shot by his own men. Even after being warned by Lee, be careful, you know what happened around here. It's almost as Longstreet goes out on a patrol to do reconnaissance, right? You don't have satellite imagery. You've got to go look at the stuff yourself. It's night, it's confusing, right? He comes back, makes noise, and his own guys shoot him. All right, and Longstreet eventually recovers, but I think he's shot through the neck. He's actually out of commission for the Overland campaign. All right, so these are the kinds of random things that happen. All right, and in Clausewitz's view, Clausewitz calls it, you know, it's friction versus genius. It's related to this issue of character. And by the way, well, Mr. Goodman, where did you hear of friction before?
We had to do a reading for warfare on Clausewitz.
Okay, all right. The Marine Corps is really into this, actually. All right. For Clausewitz, and this is partly because Clausewitz himself had been a serving general and a serving officer. The main way, and just partly because he's intellectually, he's a 19th century romantic German, is that one of the ways you overcome friction, right? And by friction, he's using a concept, it's like a machine, right, where all the gears get gummed up, right? You guys are in the naval services, this is a perfect, right? You might be, Mr. Connors might be having to lubricate things to make them work one day, right? Or telling a chief to do it, or telling a chief and then tell someone else to do it, right? That's probably the way it's going
to
work.
Tell the chief,
right?
To tell someone else to do it.
So, all right, so, because you guys are officers, right? So, how do you overcome that friction? How do you overcome the inherent problems of getting even the most basic things done? Well, for Clausewitz, in large part, it's by force of will. Right. And you can look, some of you already mentioned it. That's always been an argument for Grant's. That's why Grant's tenacity seeing is a virtue. Right. Something goes wrong. But something always goes wrong. And he finds a way to overcome it. Right. And that is the ethic we try to teach you here. Right. Something goes wrong, but what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to just give up and give excuses? No, right? You're supposed to, you're not supposed to do that. Right? But here's something I want you to think about, though. This is an academic history class. This is not a leadership class, right? And I'm not saying that the people who teach that as leadership are wrong. But one thing you might want to ask yourself at times is that really true? Right? I mean, is that, in fact, the correct way? Is that really how things occur? And that arguably is a different question. You can still make that compatible, in all honesty, with giving your all and trying to overcome things as best you can and seeing that. But that's arguably more a moral and ethical issue than one that's a historical. There are different types of historical explanations. All right, so does everyone see what I'm saying here? There's potentially one's professional ethic. You have that because of moral and ethical reasons. Whether or not that is always operative in terms of the way of explaining history correctly is actually a different issue, and is actually much more complicated. All right. So, and that's something you should consider, right? Because you see, do you guys still do Hobson's Law and things like that as a plebe? Or was it not Hobson's? I think I used to give this to Philippe Sommer. It's a story, I can't remember when, it's of a destroyer captain. Something terribly goes wrong, I forget, the ship sinks. He's asleep in his cabin, but he ends up having to take risks. I think it goes down with the ship, right? And why does he have to do that, why are CEOs relieved even if it's the subordinates who screw up? They have ultimate. Now, someone give me an argument against that.
Every time things go wrong, the CEO's in his room.
Yeah, I mean, and how can you always guarantee? I mean, and where does, what if it's a brand new engine, right? What if it's a.
Well, then they shouldn't have been doing it without having a qualified OOD.
And that's exactly the.
Which would have been signed off by the CEO,
yes,
which in
exactly,
fact would have
given right.
Them
so, the authority. And that is the Navy's ethic, right? That. And that's to make sure that every commanding officer gives his or her all in taking these responsibilities seriously. I mean, that's arguably, you have to do that as an organization. All right, do any of you, what was the most controversial thing that happened amongst Marines in Afghanistan recently? The thing that ended up on YouTube?
You're an idiot.
Yeah, what do you think is probably going to happen to the company commander? Yeah, I think everyone's actually moved on, but I don't think that person's career is going to go anywhere after this, in all honesty. All right, I'm just saying that as I have no real information about what. But why do you think that's going to be? But can he supervise every little thing that happens?
Nobody's responsible for it.
Right.
He creates the culture.
Exactly, and that's the ethic, right? But he's still responsible for the culture. He's still responsible for making sure his NCOs. And the military as an organization takes that ethic on very seriously. All right. Okay. But again, that is a professional imperative. Right. Is that the best historical explanation for things like whether or not a whole country or army wins in a war or not? Maybe not. Maybe not. Right. Can you still, you see how those are different, right? This is a question of causality versus a question of professional ethics. That being said, most military historians take the view that generals do matter. So they'll talk about things like loss of nerve, right? And sometimes they'll be incredibly critical about them, right? And there'll be sort of the military historian's version of Monday morning quarterbacking, kind of, right? So it's almost similar to rhetoric. You know, poor Joe Flacco. See what happens. You know, how is he always criticized? But is that really fair? I mean, it's things like that. All right. So now I want to throw this back. I want to come back to Grant, though. Grant, what do you think? Good general, bad general? I know I didn't really give you the case against him.
Great general.
Okay. Any dissenters? Anyone who wants to try to push back on that? Or construct an argument. Or maybe even if you don't believe it, just. Yes?
Kind of argument made. I mean, much like his strategy was just to, like, keep throwing more bodies at it until he won. Because he realized, like, well, we have more men than they do. So, you know, like, it was one battle who lost, like, 7,000 people in, like, what, like, 2 hours? So, I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's Cold Harbor. We don't think it's quite that bad. But there are plenty of things you can criticize Grant for during the Overland campaign. We now think that's actually an exaggeration.
So, I mean, things argue that he really didn't, like, look at his men. He looked at them more as, like, just objects and really, like, people. Like, my focus is to win the war, don't really care about the casualties.
And I think Weigley, by the way, kind of subscribes to that view.
I wouldn't say he doesn't care about his people. I would say more he has the hierarchy of, like, mission and then, you know, on down, understanding that he has to get a task done, knowing that he has to put forth these maneuvers that put his people at risk. And there's also arguments and, like, war theory that, you know, if you love your men, you allow them to go forth and fight. Where, like, McClellan's argument was like, oh, I love my men, I don't want to put them in the face of danger. Well, they were itching to go out and fight. So do you love your men that you're not trusting in their ability to go forth? So, I mean, I think that's just a matter of who was really in Grant's head and knows how they felt.
Mr. Goodman, let's look at other people in on this question. There's some very interesting points coming up now.
I was going to agree with her, actually. I feel that there are things that, while his men might have said that he didn't care for them because he threw them at certain situations, they also don't, being a regular private or corporal in an infantry, you don't get the strategy. You only see the tactics. So while they may see that he's throwing bodies at a certain level, they're also not seeing that he's choosing to skip certain battles and move on to certain other things and not picking every single battle across the line in order to rack up wins,
okay.
But overall get a victory on strategy.
Let me just put it. From what we know of Grant's reputation among his troops, he was, generally historians think that he was not loved. You sometimes know this by nicknames that generals get, right? So Sherman's called Uncle Billy. Lee's called Marse Robert. McClellan was called Little Mac, right? And it's not you. It's very, very much a fond. I mean, people supposedly he had these big parades, and they'd actually like parades. Not unlike, well, I know you guys all love parades. You guys live for parades, right? And McClellan would he was a great horseman, and he'd sort of do a flourish, and his troops would go crazy, and really, that's seriously true. The sense amongst historians says Grant never got that kind of nickname, but he still had a lot of, you know, he's very respected, right? And that's a different issue, right? I mean, but the question of whether or not that's an index of effectiveness. McClellan's loved, of course. McClellan arguably is not as good a general, right? But that's let me just point that out, Mr. Connors. Let me get you
in. There's kind of a Patton-esque element there, you know, old blood and guts. So, yeah, he kind of grinds the hell out of you, but at the same time, he gets victories.
Yes,
so that's
right.
that's what you appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, soldiers generally, we know from history generally that troops are willing to fight, especially if they know they're going to win. They're willing to take loss. I mean, but the trade-off has to be they have to have a sense that they're winning or getting something out of it. Okay.
I mean, I get the kind of sense that the Confederacy was already capitulating a bit, and Grant just gave the final push. Maybe not so much that, I mean, I'm not attempting to disprove that he's this amazing strategist, but I feel like maybe too much credit is given to
okay.
him. Maybe the South had already shot itself in the foot.
Right. And at the end of the Overland campaign, is the Lincoln administration's political situation in great shape? No. I mean, people are terribly disappointed at the end of the summer of 1864. And what, do you remember what battle is? What changes it?
It's Sherman.
Of course, though, the argument then is Grant deserves some credit for that, because Grant is the one who puts in motion the strategy that involves moving in different avenues of advance, right? And one of those is Sherman. And also, Grant has limitations. Some of his advances he's planning are fail because of inept field commanders. I mean, the bench of effective field commanders is very low, and Grant has political imperatives he has to respect. Okay, but that's a good subtle argument of too much credit.
Another reason that he kept his job, you mentioned Lincoln, is Lincoln was just so thrilled to have a general that was at least aggressive. And Lincoln also had more of the annihilation theory. Like, he wanted his generals to attack Lee's army, not necessarily take Richmond, which I know McClellan was more about trying to take Richmond. So it lined up better, and Lincoln needed somebody who would do something,
okay,
whether you want or not.
And that's maybe not so much Grant's doing as it is Lincoln's. Right, Mr. Connors.
I think Grant's biggest failings are tactical, not strategic. I think everybody can agree that he's strategically very good, but tactically less so. And perfect example of that, again, is Wilderness and Sharpsburg. Because Wilderness, again, he gets his flanks turned. So that generally denotes bad tactical skills.
And Cold Harbor would also certainly be a
Cold Harbor, example. The Battle of the Angle.
Well, but that's not Grant, right? That's... You're thinking of Sharpsburg. You're thinking of Antietam.
Sharpsburg.
Same thing.
Yes.
Antietam. McClellan. 62. September.
Spotsylvania.
Okay. The angle. All right. That. Okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. That you can certainly criticize the way we'll walk that ground, or those of you on the staff, right? But the way the assaults are made are open to question. All right. Although in Grant's defense, is it Grant's job to be doing tactical level stuff?
No, it's supposed to be Meade.
It's supposed to be his staff and Meade. And so there's arguably an organizational issue there as much as anything else. Right? I mean, it's Grant, part of Grant's struggle in the Overland campaign is, and this is not clear in the readings you have, Grant has two very different and profoundly conflicting hats. He is, in effect, the field commander in a very awkward commander relationship with Meade. He is the field commander in the field of the Army of the Potomac, fighting Lee. But what else is he supposed to do? And Weigley talks a lot about it.
Commander-in-chief.
He is coordinating all the federal armies. All right. This is as if General Dempsey had to do his job as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff while being in Afghanistan as the ISAF commander. Right? Why do we not do things that way?
It reduces effectiveness.
Yeah. It's too much for one person. It's really too much for one person. Right? It's kind of absurd. But that's, I mean, the American system is bureaucratically very, has all sorts of weird quirks in it. This is one of the quirks of it. Right? This is why Halleck is such a failure at the end of the day, we think. Because Halleck should have played that role of keeping the big picture. And you guys, Halleck was a great, was, well, there are really not that many great American military writers in the pre-Civil War period, but Halleck's the best you've got, pretty much. All right. Well, there's Dennis Hartmahan up at West Point, but he's too old. So Halleck's the only one in uniform. And he doesn't do that. And Grant eventually takes up that role. So you can make, in his defense, he's kind of pulled in too many different directions, and that's one of the reasons why you get some of these failings. Right. I do want to come back, though, to Mr. Nye's point. I mean, what is, this is, arguably, there is sometimes a conflict, though, between McClellan is loved by his men, but can you love your men too much? Does that make you a, I mean, do people really buy that, or is that, or is this different types of, well, okay, let me let you discuss it, Mr. Roth.
Well, it's related to sports. If you're going to play, like, shy and all that, you're going to get hurt. So if you're not aggressive and you're not taking the fight to them, it's going to be more, you're going to hurt yourself worse because when the attack does come, you're not going to be ready for it. So building on Grant, like, always pushing, always being aggressive, looking for the right fight and all that, like, he was protecting his men. Well, McClellan was kind of like, oh, I don't want to go there and all that. So when a big fight did come, they weren't really ready for it.
All right. I mean, McClellan does take a lot of casualties also. I mean, and he doesn't get much for it. I mean, that's an argument. How about Mr. Mallon?
And then also, I mean, like Christina said, I mean, these men enlisted to fight and obviously fight for something that they believed in or they were paid to do. And so by not allowing them to fight and, you know, by trying to protect their lives, I think McClellan and the other generals were doing them a disservice because they didn't sign up to sit in camp or, you know, just wear the uniform. You know, in theory, they signed up to fight and to win battles. But
anyone want to?
Wasn't there a draft? Like, some of them were pressed in?
Yes, by 63. And then you have a lot of people who are, I think I mentioned this in the previous class, the draft works in part, not many men are directly conscripted, but what happens is states are given quotas. And they have to, they're incentivized, the states are incentivized to pay a lot of commutation money, a lot of bonus money.
And a lot of people, even though they were with the draft, they were able to get out of it by getting someone else to go.
Exactly. So, right, substitutes. So, yeah. So they're not all completely volunteers by this point in the war.
Didn't the draft come in after McClellan was already replaced?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but we're talking about Grant, right?
Right. Yeah, if Manley's arguing that he's doing a disservice to his men by keeping them in camp when they wanted to fight, and then the counterpoint to that being the draft. The draft doesn't apply to McClellan.
Yeah, fair enough.
And then also, I mean, by not allowing them to fight and not allowing them to win battles, you could also argue that whoever does this is prolonging the war, which in the long term is losing more lives.
Okay. I mean, that's there's kind of a conflict between short term and long term, and that's then it's not adjudicating it correctly. All right. That's okay. Anyone else want to, Mr. Roth?
By putting your men in a battle, you have trust in them. You have trust that they'll come through and win. And by like shying away, like they realize, like, oh, general doesn't want us to fight this battle because he doesn't think we can win this one. And if that happens over and over again, like, why are we like the group of misfits?
You guys are giving the very good institutional response, right? And it's perfectly defensible. But let me push back a little bit. All right, John Bell Hood. Okay, incredibly aggressive, right? Men quite fond of him. What happens? He destroys his own army, in effect, right, by attacking. All right. I forget his name. Is my good friend and colleague, Joe Glattar, who's a Civil War historian at UNC Chapel Hill, is a great, one of his books. It's in the Western Army, Sherman's Army, and he has here a story about, I can't remember which one, it's a corps commander who's very effective, very aggressive, but somewhat disliked by his men because he's seen as a bit too aggressive, a bit too ambitious. Right? I mean, so there's a fine line between, troops want to win, and troops understand they have to do certain things to do that. But when do you have an officer who maybe wants that glory a little bit too much?
You also have to think about the different dynamic between the officers and how they got, or the generals and how they got in their position. So you've got your political generals who are there literally just to appease, you know, border states and people with their specific opinions. And then you've got the generals who are literally, like, militarily efficient. So you have to look at the different backgrounds and, like, how they got in those positions. Lincoln appoints people as political generals, and they've had no experience ever before, and they're leading green troops themselves. And then you've got people who are very, very familiar with battlefield tactics and things of that nature, and they're viewed as overly aggressive, but they're the ones who have the best knowledge and experience in the field. So who do you criticize?
Fair enough, although I'll point out that a lot of times political generals are in place because out of respect to the desires of the troops, right? I mean, if especially in these, you know, some of these controversial German immigrant generals, guys like Karl Schurz, Franz Sigel, all of whom have extraordinarily dubious military careers. But I fight Schmidt Sigel. That used to be the joke of what, you know, do you even get that? Have you heard? Yes, exactly, right? So, you know, a lot, they command German-speaking, you know, the German-speaking communities are actually politically quite important. A lot of them still use German. If you do serious antebellum political history, sometimes you have to learn German to read their newspapers in the U.S. Well, it depends on where you're working, like a place like St. Louis, maybe. But, you know, the political, I mean, it's partly because out of respect to, I mean, all the reports are correct, but let me just, you know, point that out. You know, sometimes you have examples where this is kind of a conflict. I mean, I don't, that, you know, at times negotiating the gap between the potential conflict between concern for one's troops, what the troops want to do, and overall mission accomplishment, maybe there may be a conflict there, right? And there may be a way to square it in the long view, on the big view, but this may look much more ambiguous. And I've seen this in counterinsurgency settings, right? So, do you think all senior NCOs are really thrilled with all these restrictions on escalation of force and ROE and stuff like that? No, they're not. No, I've seen, and these are platoon sergeants who do what they're told to do, but who are like, they don't like these rules. And what does the officer have to do? Enforce them, right? Okay. I mean, a lot of times the marker of a good unit is when the especially the NCO's modern unit, is when they do stuff that they don't want to do, but they still do it. They'll grumble a little bit, especially if it's a senior non-com who's having a private conversation with his company commander or something like that. But what do they do at the end of the day? They care, yeah. That's the ethic that's taught, and that's more or less the ethics that's been absorbed, especially in high quality organizations. But there is a conflict. I mean, I don't want you to think, you know, these things can get very messy on the ground, and historically that's certainly the case too. Right. Okay, so here's a question. A lot of times historians also phrase that, I think the consensus view of all in all honesty, Lee was pretty good also. I mean, it's although there's more of a debate, although perhaps that's just because Lee lost, right? So he's more open to criticism because he was the guy on the losing side. And Grant's harder to criticize because if you can say all these bad things about Grant, but what does he do at the end of the day? He wins, right? Maybe he wins ugly, but he wins, right? So a lot of times the debate comes down to, did he win too ugly? Could he have won at a more efficient rate, whatever that means? All that being said, who here thinks that Lee is superior to Grant? Who here would take Lee over Grant? Okay, so 10. Who takes Grant? And then you have the right to abstain.
Is this as a commander in chief or
the better general, whatever that means, your own criteria.
Bar fight.
No, not in a bar fight. As in, and of course, midshipmen would never involve themselves Grant in such activities. Or who would take Grant over Lee?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I think there's an 8. There's people. All right, 8 or 9. Okay, well, it's by, all right, Lee by nose. That's interesting. All right, I'm a little bit surprised by that, but.
You need to do one of those simulator mashups.
Oh, yeah.
On the History Channel.
No. Yeah.
Spike TV.
All right. Okay. I'll see you guys on Monday, Mr. Blair. All right. See you. Have a good weekend.
I think the bigger...
like considering here is level 10.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, it would.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, and he wasn't even in charge.
And Burnside's defense,
no.
Burnside never thought he was fit to be commander of the army. He didn't want it. And it's the administration's fault
that they made.
I mean, that is a flag.
I'm sorry.
Right? If you say I am not suitable for this, you don't keep the job for that guy.
I was like.
And you can't lie, man.
I was going to say independence.
He's really he's a better engineer than he is.
Apparently, and he never
his rifle is very good.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that one.
It's not a weekend.
I think you're fucked.
It's not.
April 15th, 1912. Nearly 1,500 perish.